The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Life of Flow podcast. Today, we're fortunate enough to have Francois Hamon. I think I butchered that name. And he is a biologist that studies basically humans in extreme conditions. And today, we're going to talk about cold therapy. Cold plunges and all these things we kind of see on social media, and that I've personally jumped on an ice bath. I guess now I don't know if I feel smart or dumb.
My friend Ahmed made me do it once.
Yeah.
It was cool.
And you ordered one for your house.
It's on the way.
I guess, yeah. Maybe you'll turn it back. But anyways, we discuss at a really high level the science behind it, the do's and do nots, the real research behind it, if it's really supportive of all this crazy stuff that we're seeing lately, or if it isn't,
and
you guys can make your own decision. All right,
vamos. Vámonos.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Francois Hamon, a very famous person. I would say one of our top contenders here in the Life of Flow podcast for highly influential, followed social media frenzy, and potentially out there, all of you thinking for one reason, but actually I think it's not. And I'm talking about all this craziness about cold plunging. All the famous people are doing it. Everybody thinks now you should just get a bucket of ice and dip yourself in there and your life will become better overnight. And I came into this thinking that, Francois, you were going to just sweep me off my feet and make me feel so good for the thing that I purchased. I've got this device on the way to my house that's going to help me do cold plunges. But lo and behold, people, this is a data-driven man, and I believe that maybe he doesn't...
He's going to make you return.
He doesn't like the hype. Yeah. So, first of all, let's just dig into it. How about, if you don't mind, educate the people out there that are watching us today. Do you consider yourself a cold, like a cold therapy, cold effect, cold in human effect expert?
Well, I've done it for 25 years, so I'm not sure if that makes me a cold expert, but I've done it all my life. I'm a biologist.
What's your background? Yeah.
So my background is biology. So for me, the whole evolution of, you know, animals and the whole concept of cold has been part of my research for since the beginning of my research field. So
what made you go into
more than
that?
30 years. And you know, it's funny.
Let me interrupt you. Made you? What makes a man decide, I'm just going to study cold?
Because cold is cool, so you become the cool researcher. So when that's not taken, so I did a lot of heat exposure too. I basically work on anything that stresses
extreme.
The body. Extreme temperatures.
Extreme so conditions.
I did high altitude. I did a lot of hot, so I could be a hot researcher too. But anyway, but the whole idea was basically that for me, cold became a stressor that humans really suck at. Humans were not made to basically face cold conditions. We evolve in very warm conditions. We made the decision at some point to leave areas that were warm to go into the cold areas. And the only way we survived was with shelter, working together, clothing, and fire. So most of the adaptations to cold, and when I say adaptations, I basically mean genetic adaptations, come from basically behavior in the cold and not necessarily from our physiology. So even though we might think that some humans are amazingly tolerant to cold, they're amazingly tolerant to cold because they make the right decisions. And when it comes to heat, we can tolerate heat. We can sweat like no other mammal can sweat. We do extremely well in the shade and we're able to survive in these conditions as long as we have access to water and shade and any type of protection from the sun. But cold is not something that we can face very easily. And the risks of cold are tremendous.
But Francois, there's inevitably different, you know, genetics throughout the Homo sapiens, right? And you have cultures historically that have been phenomenal at surviving cold temperatures. I don't know, Eskimos, Vikings, who knows? Like, are there genetic adaptations that humans have throughout times that I bet you if you compared, I don't know, somebody that comes from the Sahara Desert versus somebody that lives in the North Pole, there's got to be some genetic makeup that makes them a little bit different in the way that they can coexist with these extreme temperatures. Is that not so? Or is it just the fact that they've got the right clothing?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a combination of everything, right? So your best protection against cold is basically your body mass. Your body mass is what protects you from facing these conditions. And so when you look at a lot of these Nordic countries, you will get kind of these higher mass individuals that are better protected. But even with this said, if you look at the Inuit populations, especially in North, so I worked in Northern Canada for many years, and you look at the Inuit population, the average body weight was about 150 pounds, right? So it was about 120 pounds. So we're talking about 63 kilos. So I don't know what that comes out to. So people were not tremendously large, but what people had was the right behavior to protect themselves, but the access to food was far less. So there's always that balance between food access and cold, and behavior actually can protect you from these very cold conditions. So of course there would be some differences, like you would see the length of fingers, a lot of these protective. So the more you're made in a spherical manner, morphologically, the more you're protected. The longer appendages you have, the more you can lose heat, but you're more at risk in the cold. So these things do, you can see these, maybe these differences, but the differences are not that obvious. And behavior is the very obvious one. I would challenge a lot of people right now to go into the cold and try to survive, even though they've been living in these cold countries. And I can tell you in Canada, for a lot of people, that would be tremendously challenging, independently of their morphology, to survive in the cold because they don't have the right behaviors.
And so what's cold? You know, so, at what temperature do we say, okay, this is cold?
So cold is basically starts when we start losing heat to the environment at a higher rate than your basal values. And I basically, as soon as my skin temperature is at a temperature lower than ambient, I lose to that environment. It's a gradient, right? So cold for humans starts very rapidly because our skin temperature is at 33 degrees Celsius. So it doesn't take very long for us to start losing to the environment. So without clothing, cold basically occurs even when it's just a small drop in ambient temperature. And I'm always amazed because when I see people, you know, at temperatures around 20 degrees Celsius saying it's cold, I'm always amazed for them to see this, to say that, because for me, when you think about most of the cold research, we would never classify that as cold, but this is how vulnerable we are to cold, right?
So
listen, as Hispanics, anything under like 26 is cold, man.
Like my grandmother puts a sweater at like 75.
I was about to say, yeah, if, you know, you're not Hispanic if your kid doesn't go out and it's 21, 22 degrees and they're fully sweatered. They've got a little hoodie. Like, it's funny when I take my kid to Costa Rica, but them grandmothers just run out and try to like suit him up. And I'm like, let him be. Yeah. He's in a diaper running around. It's like 17 degrees Celsius. That was fine.
I don't know Celsius.
So, anyways. You see, that just makes you a sucky Hispanic because him and I know what 17 Celsius feels like. You got to stop saying you're Hispanic if you don't know what a Celsius is.
Sorry, man. I'm from Puerto Rico.
Gringos.
Yeah. We got like...
These gringos, Francois. These gringos.
Yeah. So when it comes to cold, when you think about it, like if I go from just feeling cold right at the beginning, all the way to the ice bath, I think that would be a range of cold, right? And most of the research will be located within that continuum. So there's two types of cold. There's a cold which we call compensable cold, which means that I can get into the cold, shiver like crazy, but my core temperature won't fall. And I remember when I started publishing, it was funny because I had to convince people of this. People go, you cannot shiver if your core temperature does not go down. Well, that's not true. So humans can shiver even to maximal level, to very, very high level, and it doesn't mean that their core temperature went down, just from the skin response. So the skin response is sufficient to induce that shivering response, which doesn't mean that I'm hypothermic. So this is non-compensable. This is compensable. Non-compensable is when my heat loss is so important that my core temperature will start coming down. So this occurs a lot in ice water. Anytime or any type of cold water, as soon as you hit cold water, so for example, if you put water at 18 degrees Celsius, which would be spring or fall water temperature in lakes, it would take you about 90 minutes if you stay in there. You're forced to stay in there because you're both capsized and you're stuck in there to start becoming highly hypothermic at 35.5 degrees Celsius. If I take ice water, it's going to take minutes for me to become hypothermic. And as soon as I hit that ice water, within 2 minutes, I start falling into the hypothermia range. So again, everything's a question of rate. To be able to be uncompensable, water does it extremely well. And air, it's much harder to become hypothermic in cold air unless it's a very prolonged amount of time.
Francois, the first time I heard about this, about kind of cold therapy, was first kind of athletes, you know, after, especially the college athletes and stuff, after hard trainings, they go into ice baths. Then you start kind of seeing the cryo chambers. I remember seeing, like, I was like a fan of boxing. So I would see, like, you know, high-level boxers going into cryo chambers. And I think that was like 2010s, the first time I saw that. And now you see a lot of people, especially a lot of young professionals, you know, getting into the whole ice bath phenomenon. And there is, you know, there's conversations around metabolic health, improvement in metabolic health, improvement in dopamine levels and such. Is there any like strong data to support this? Like, what's the research behind this, and how much is it actually fact or highly generalizable?
So again, it comes to the question, you know, data talks, bullshit walks. And at the end of the day, a lot of people have thrown a lot of these benefits and say, okay, it does all of this. Does the science back it up? Who's going to go to PubMed and have a look at these science papers and go, okay, this is being backed up? And I would tell you that most of the stuff you see is not backed up by science. Very little is backed up by science. And a lot of this science needs to start being built. But again, social media is going to move way faster. Again, we're feeding an industry here of people developing these cold therapies and developing all these things. So let's start with the first one, which is the immune system. There's no clear evidence at all that the immune system is being improved by cold. And it's actually extremely challenging to test that question and actually to quantify what is the effect of cold on the immune system without voluntarily infecting people, which again, ethically, would not be something that would be possible. People will say, like, well, let's look at the change in lymphocytes and that's going to give me my answer. No, the immune system is way more complex than that. And it's not because my lymphocytes are changing that necessarily my immune system is getting much, much better. So that's the first one that really, again, tunes the immune system, no clear evidence whatsoever. The other one that becomes, again, a bit more evident is the one related to inflammation. And there's been a lot of claims, again, that inflammation is improved by cold. And we all know this. Somebody gets injured, you put ice on somebody on your limb, and it's basically going to help prevent some of the swelling and allow some of that vasoconstriction, get the blood flow away. And this is going to be a huge reduction in pain. Does it do anything else? Do you think it would do anything else?
I have no idea.
Yeah. So basically, the main thing is to basically reduce the amount of pain that you would have and reduce the blood flow in that region. But at the whole body level, we have no evidence whatsoever. And actually, a recent paper from Michael Tipton showed that out of 8 papers published, we're only talking about 8 papers published on inflammation and cold. And for Dr. Tipton from University of Portsmouth, who's been an expert of cold for more than 30 years, to say that there's only 8 good papers to look at is because there's only 8 good papers to look at. And there was no clear evidence that it could have any benefits in terms of inflammation at the whole body level. there might be a trend towards it, but right now it's not fully backed up by science. The one that becomes very obvious to me in terms of benefits, and again, this is the one that's a bit harder to figure out, is people feel good when they do cold exposure. They actually say, when I get into the cold, I feel good. So one thing we know about cold, it releases noradrenaline. So basically catecholamines go up. Noradrenaline is a stimulant. So it gives you a little boost in the morning. So it's like your little, instead of caffeine shot, you get your noradrenaline shot in the morning. And it also increases dopamine. So these are well-known facts. And that stimulation might be by itself enough to create that good feeling when I get into the cold. So again, cold showers, right, for example, would be one good example of it. If I take a cold shower in the morning, make the decision to turn on that cold water, and suddenly I get that little boost of energy that makes me feel good.
Is there a difference between like 55 degrees that your shower might be at, or like 34 degrees, which might be an ice bath, as far as like that benefit of dopamine or norepinephrine?
So not fully quantified. And one of the issues is a lot of cold studies are not well standardized. So they're very hard to compare between themselves. So if I take a cold shower, for me as a scientist, I would never use cold shower as a way of determining an effect of cold on a response, because again, I have no control over it. It would be like telling somebody, go for a run outside. I'll measure you now. I'll take all the measurements I need. Go run outside. When you come back, I'll do the post measurements. So for me, there's no difference. Like, I have no control. When I started doing cold back in 2000, when I started my PhD, the first thing I did is to go through the literature and say, how do you control cold? And you guys would not have believed the mess in the literature in terms of how people control cold. There was no control. They threw people in ice water, cold water, at any different temperatures, cold chambers. But again, if I'm doing this, or I, you know, all my body's exposed, I'm not going to get the same responses. So I opted to use a cooling suit. So what I do in the lab is I use a cooling suit, which is funny because you're a bear hugger. Same principle, but I flow cold water through the cooling suit. Right. And my cooling suit allows me to clamp skin temperature. I can clamp it very precisely and look at any metabolic response that I want. So I have full control of the skin temperature, which allows me to standardize my cold response and look at any metabolic effect or any physiological effects that I want. But most studies will not be done that way. Most studies will be done, let's just hope for the best. We do showers, we do ice dipping, we do whatever, and then we try to draw conclusions.
Francois, what's the main obstacle? I mean, it seems like we're at a stage in contemporary science where, I mean, it's not rocket science to understand that it could be a fairly straightforward randomized study, right? I grab 100 college students and 100 college students. 100 get the cold baths on some sort of controlled system. The others don't. And I figure out some metabolic things. I can measure neurotransmitters. I don't know. I can figure out a million other ways that this should be, at this stage of contemporary science, objectivized. So what have been the hiccups? You've been working at this for years. You've mentioned already two pretty good authors that have been at it for years, but we do PubMed searches and there's only 8 articles. So why has it been so hard to get some hard data on something that seems to be rather, you know, straightforward, or that one can think about a good way to potentially test it?
Yeah. So it's funny, you know, it comes a little bit to the, you know, the question about why would I even study cold? It's funny because right now in Canada, not too many people got into cold research with humans. I mean, there's very few of them. A lot of the research was associated with military work. So a lot of it was military research. And so I work with colleagues at USARIM, at the U.S. Army Research Institute for Environmental Medicine in Natick. And one of the things, we were kind of comparing notes, and I'm going, why is it so difficult to recruit for cold? People don't like cold. There's a reason why it's so difficult to recruit for cold. A lot of people will not enjoy it, right? So even if I tell you, you know, cold's going to be the solution to obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, well, we've been saying for years that losing weight by eating less and, you know, having a better diet, more nutritious diet, exercising regularly, that's how you're going to deal with cardiovascular disease, obesity, and diabetes. And now I'm going to show up and say, no, forget about this. Now you're going to do cold exposure, and I'm going to fix the problem with cold exposure. We're running trials right now in the lab, and people are basically being exposed to cold and caloric restriction alone or control. And everybody that does cold looks at us at the end and goes, this is super tough. This is so difficult. This is controlled conditions. We expose them on a regular basis. This is not, I get into the ice plunge or bear plunge, get my Instagram picture, do it once, and now suddenly I'm a cold plunger. That has nothing to do with it. Or other people that will basically be willing to do this every single day, which is a very small fraction of the population that do it every single day. So the reason why it's difficult is that it's difficult to recruit participants for cold studies. People don't look for them. People are not that excited to do cold exposure.
When I've done bouts of like cold showers, and it reminded me.
Are you doing cold showers now?
No, they're not cold now.
Like, why?
Because it's not that cold in Texas. Like in the winter.
Oh, so you're saying your cold water right now is not cold?
No, it's like 60 degrees, so it's not that cold. I mean, this.
Do you warm your water? Do you take a shower with warm water or no?
No, I mean, most of the time, yeah. Mm. Yeah, I know. But anyway, I've done bouts of it, and it reminded me of, I did a CrossFit for a while, especially when I came out of residency, I had a little more time. And it gave me a degree of like mental toughness, felt like. It gives me
resilience?
Yeah, it's like, okay, if I did this, especially when I, you know, when I was in CrossFit, if I could do a session of CrossFit in the morning at 5 a.m., everything else in the day is going to be pretty easy. And doing cold showers, I feel, kind of gives you that sense. Is there any way to like quantify resilience as an effect of it?
Yeah, so it's fascinating because what you're talking about is basically some of the work that I've developed out of my research. So when I saw the big fad into getting into ice baiting and all that type of stuff, and I said, you know what? I would love to work. So I worked with NATO, and I was working in Finland, and I was looking at people being exposed on a regular basis to cold and doing saunas and all that type of stuff. And I thought, you know what? Resilience is extremely important. And I started doing work with the military, developing workshops to develop resilience, using cold as my medium to be able to develop that sense of resilience. And it's, you know, when you get into ice water, your reflex is a fight or flight response.
Yeah.
You don't want to go in there. And I've seen tough people, like, you know, amazingly tough operators that are used to facing tremendous conditions, looking at the ice bath going, my God, like, this is your pain box. This is going to friggin' hurt. So for you to make that decision, and again, the reason why it hurts, by the way, is because it's a nauseous response when you get into ice water. It's a nauseous response because there are nauseous receptors that operate below 15 degrees Celsius. And what you feel is not necessarily cold. What you feel is pain. So when you hit that ice water, you got to deal with pain. And for some people, it's easy. For some people, it's tremendously difficult. And what we do is we train in a way that is, it's not about how long you stay in. And actually, you just should not stay in longer than 2 minutes, maybe push it to 3 minutes, but never more than that. There's no need to go any more than 2 or 3 minutes. But the idea is to face it in a way that you remain in full control. Because the first reaction that you're going to get when you hit that ice water is cold shock. Your body wants you out of there, just wants you to hit that water and get out. And what you're going to do is take, as soon as you hit the water, take a deep inhalation. And that's the reflex. If your head's underwater, chance of drowning are extremely high. So we teach people to exhale. You get that big, big change in vasoconstriction and that big vagal response that's going to come hit you, telling you, get the hell out. And now you need to sit with the suck. And you need to accept the suck for another minute and a half. And this is the feeling that you're talking about, that resilience that develops, is when you realize that, man, I got this. And you can actually see people's faces change. They hit that ice water, and then 30 seconds later, and I've coached a lot of people, and I do it regularly, people's faces change, and they look at you and go, I got this.
I got this. Is there any reason besides any quantifiable, you know, data supported reason why people should do it or could do it, or might be there might be any benefit at all?
So I think the feeling good benefit, I think, is a tremendous benefit. You know, I think the stimulation that you get out of it, I think, is a tremendous benefit. Right now, we cannot back it up with metabolic responses, saying metabolic responses will be improved. Are we going to be able to change the risk of diabetes and obesity using cold and even cardiovascular disease? The answer is clearly no. And a lot of that big change happened in 2009 when we found brown fat. So three main papers came out in New England Journal of Medicine, one coming out of New York, one coming out of University of Maastricht in the Netherlands, and one coming out of Finland. And the three of them showed that adult humans had brown fat. Everybody went insane to try to show that brown fat was going to be the solution to obesity and diabetes. There's been no proof of that. And thousands of papers have been published. The reasons are that cold is not that enjoyable. And people will not be exposing themselves on a regular basis. People need to eat well. People need to exercise. And people need to have a healthy lifestyle. That's going to make the difference. Will cold do it? Cold is not going to do it.
Yeah, because I could see that the people that would do it would probably self-select, and there'd be a huge selection bias.
Huge selection bias.
As to the people that are going to eat well, they're going to exercise. Because if you have the motivation to jump in ice water every morning, you're going to have the motivation to eat a salad and go to the gym.
Yeah.
So I could see how they'd be extremely difficult to separate those effects.
And the other thing is, when you think about even exercise, you know, in terms of training for losing weight, what's very important is the volume. Volume is key. We call it the FIT principle. Frequency, intensity, time, and type, if you want. What type of exercise are you doing? But the volume is key to create that calorie deficit, to be able to get enough energy expenditure. When it comes to cold, and to look at any benefits of cold, the volume is also important. You need regular exposure to this. So now people will do it. Again, what's amazing in North America is people love, when you say 2 minutes of cold is good, I'll go in for 20 minutes because it's going to be 20 times better.
That's a very Texas way to do things.
Yeah. So you just freaking multiply. Yeah. So if I say cold is good, I'll go into the ice water because it's going to be way better than just exposing myself regularly to cold.
So then, you know, why? All right. So my take home message thus far is the science is not there. There's a bit of a social media frenzy because it feels good. Mm-hmm. The same way listening to music or getting a body massage,
yoga, these other, relaxation, meditation.
The way all these other things that potentially, I'm not sure that there is scientific, you know, irrefutable scientific data that shows that meditation is going to make you better, although I'm pretty sure that there are some cardiovascular effects. So then everybody
are
that
there any cardiovascular effects of the Cheetos you're eating right now?
They're not Cheetos. They're Nutter Butters.
If you eat them in the cold, you'll do way better.
These are Nutter Butters. And if somebody does not know what a Nutter Butter is, then they're missing out. they're cold Nutter Butters too. No. So what I'm getting to is then should everybody that's tickled by this and feels good, do it? And is there anything wrong that could come from this? Because, I mean, you and I come from a world where hypothermia is like really bad.
It's a bad thing, yeah.
Right? We constantly fight hypothermia in the operating room. My wife is a nurse at Texas Children. And one of the things that I hate when I get called to that hospital is that they keep the ORs hot.
Yeah.
Like you will lose 10% of your body weight
from sweating
because children are even more susceptible to a lot of the complications secondary to hypothermia. So they will not, even though a surgeon may want to keep the OR at 55, they will not let you drop that temperature.
Yeah.
And we have the bear huggers and all these other things. So, you know, and that's scientifically proven, right? I mean, I guess that we have enough data to show that even in profound hypothermia, let's say something that we know about very, very well, that we know by, as a matter of fact, is platelet aggregation goes to shit. And all of a sudden, you could be trying to do a vascular surgery.
Severe coagulopathy.
And there's bleeding all over the place and you just can't get anything to stop.
Yeah.
And you've been there. I've been there in trauma and severe, you know, the patient, you know, not now, but like in Germany, you know, in a really horrible temperatures, trauma, motor vehicle accident, hypothermic patient bleeding, they're really catastrophic problem. So with that in the back, Francois, what is this healthy medium? And should there be people that just shouldn't be doing? And or is there an okay thing that you should do? You know, what's the solution? If the science isn't there to back this up, but we know that some people feel great and there's mental health issues are on the uprise. And so anything that makes you feel good should be part of our daily practice. But we know that too much is bad. What's that healthy medium in your opinion?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what it's all about, right? And we don't like healthy mediums. What we like is, again, when you see a fad, you just go crazy with it. And this is what I'm going to do now. And this is going to fix everything, right? Eat, anchovies is going to save your life because there's a correlation that was created in a paper and everybody goes crazy for anchovies. So when it comes to cold, some of the risks are actually super well documented. And I'm going to throw a question to you guys. Do you guys remember in the First World War, what happened to these foot soldiers that were stuck in the trench?
Frostbite.
Frostbite. Mm-hmm. Right? You want to get papers, well-documented information, the amount of energy being put by the militaries around the world in Nordic countries facing trench foot. 9 out of 10 injuries in the cold are trench foot.
Oh, wow.
But can you get that from really short exposures?
You can get that from repeated ice water bathing. And I've seen some people with tremendous we call them basically non-freezing cold injuries. So we can call them trench foot if we want, but let's go for the sexy scientific term, which is non-freezing cold injury, which is basically neurological damage, most likely related to glutamate metabolism within the nerves. And the damage can be permanent. And I've seen some soldiers with tremendous issues of trench foot from regular exposure to the cold. A lot of these ice baiters who do it on a regular basis have so much damage at their hands and feet because a lot of them do not protect their hands and their feet. The first message I give is protect your hands and protect your feet. And if you go around and you look at these gurus doing it, a lot of people don't even mention this as even a risk related to repeated cold exposure. This is a super well-documented risk. So non-freezing cold injuries, to me, is the biggest concern when it comes to these regular cold exposures.
So, obviously I live in Austin, and Austin, all these things are like super popular. And I've been hearing people talk about going super hot sauna, then jump in the cold plunge and do that like multiple times, like 4 or 5.
Yeah, you go back
times.
And forth.
Yeah. It sounds a little insane. Is there any chance of increasing neurological damage from that extreme change back and forth?
Or is it better? Is it better because you're counter?
Yeah, there you go.
I don't know.
So we're thinking dynamic right now. We're thinking stretching, vasodilation, and vasoconstriction. So one of the issues that people have is when they get obsessed with cold. So when I was in Finland, I was working with the military in Finland, and we do sauna every single night, and we just cool down in the snow. We don't get into the ice water. We cool down with snow, and then we do the cycle again. Again, okay. European standard is not to go to these very extreme necessarily, is to create a behavior that you can repeat on a daily basis. And I've seen very little non-freeze and cold injuries in Finland, and people do this on a regular basis. When I got back to Canada and I did my first cold water dip, I go, my God, I feel way better. So I read up on this. I got on the PubMed, and a colleague of mine, Dr. Igor Megavic from Slovenia, wrote a paper showing that to improve your tolerance to cold, you could do it with heat exposure, no cold exposure. You did a study with biking in the heat, and what you show is hand and feet temperature is actually higher once you face cold. So exactly in that sense, where by creating that vasodilation and CIBD, cold-induced vasodilation, with heat acclimation, you actually do better in the cold. The opposite thing would be for me to do ice baiting nonstop. You know, one of the example I could give, I'm doing a bicep curl and that's all I do. I don't want to stretch out. I'm only doing the bicep curl. I'm going to end up with my arm like this. But if I go full extent, vasodilation, vasoconstriction, vasodilation, vasoconstriction, I'm improving the tone of the vasculature. And actually the capacity to vasodilate is going to be much, much better. So in my mind, the contrasting baths actually can do a lot of benefits. Can we back it up scientifically? No, we can't right now. But we know that sauna actually reduces risk of cardiovascular disease. This has been well published in a lot of literature in Finland. We have no convincing evidence for cold, and I haven't seen anything for contrasting.
But so you're saying you have more capacity to vasodilate if you do both? Than if you just do sauna?
If you do sauna, your vasodilation is going to do really well.
Fine.
But if I do cold, my vasoconstriction, but if I only do cold, I'm only focusing on the vasoconstriction. And yeah. My hand and feet temperature could actually be lower once I face cold.
Okay, interesting.
Why is sauna? So
you should return your cold
bath. And change it for a sauna.
Buy a sauna.
You know, they have these little saunas that are like portable, you could put in your backyard.
You should put it here in your office.
I could put one here in my office.
Anyways.
Yeah, like in the bathroom, I can have it.
So,
you know, I know we're getting a little bit close to the end, but what current studies are you working on? Like, if we were to invite you with, which I would hope that you would come, let's say a year or two from now, based on the current work that you're involved in, what do you think are questions that you will have some more categorical answers for?
So one of the things that is very important for cold that hasn't been done well is how do you standardize cold? And I think this is an extremely important thing. And a lot of people, again, I've been exposing to cold in many different ways and trying to draw these conclusions. I think what's very important is to create a method that is reproducible, right? This is the basis of science. If I can reproduce it, then why am I doing it? So for me, from the get-go, back in 2000, it was really important for me to control my conditions. I use a cooling suit, control my skin. And we're going to start looking at some of these responses. So we did a lot of work on metabolic responses, changes in brown fat, changes in acclimation, basically trying to reduce the amount of shivering, which is very important when you're exposed regularly to cold, because it is very challenging. But the effects of cold acclimation is really where a lot of research needs to focus on. If I do repeated cold exposures, what changes in metabolism can I observe? And these are the studies that are very difficult to do. So these are the studies we'll keep doing in the lab for sure. And be able to look at changes in blood flow and in the periphery. So this is what's going to make a difference for people to tolerate cold is making sure you get good blood flow in the hands and feet. That really makes a big difference. The other component that we're looking at, again, related more to cold therapy, is the effect on changes that would be related to let's say stuff like heart rate variability, for example, trying to see whether my parasympathetic sympathetic tone is being affected by these by this cold exposure. And if you do this on a regular basis, does it have any impact on actually what people are describing, reducing, making you healthier, making you, you know, less anxious, all that type of stuff? Could cold actually have any type of these effects? So these are things we'll be looking at. A lot of the work will be related to pain tolerance also, or pain management. So I've been doing some work with veterans here in Canada, and we're looking at the effects of cold therapy to reduce the amount of pain. And again, these are things that are important to look at. Inflammation, immune system is something that is extremely challenging that I haven't been getting into, but I think inflammation is one factor that is very important to get to.
That's awesome. Well, I think we're getting here to the last couple of minutes of the podcast. Thank you so much, Francois, for giving us and being so gracious with your time. Is there any kind of final message you would like to kind of emphasize to our audience and before we wrap up?
Yeah, for sure. And the thing is, you know, a lot of people have been looking to social media for advice in terms of any type of metabolic benefits of all kinds of stuff. I think people do need to talk to people that are knowledgeable about these stressors, because these stressors can actually have tremendous impact. And to talk to your physician and discuss some of the risks. And I, you know, we haven't touched on some of these risks, but there is cardiovascular risks of that cold plunging, you know, risk of cardiac arrest coming from high, increased blood pressure, cardiac arrest coming from vagal shock. All these things need to be discussed. And just to understand that, again, you're responsible, just like you would be in any type of other type of extreme exposure, to check on, to fact check before you actually do this types of very high stress exposure.
That's awesome.
I'm not sure if I'm going to return my thing.
I would keep it. I think you're going to enjoy it.
Change it for a sauna.
Yeah.
Yeah, just put the sauna next to it.
Made the sauna and the thing in there.
Yeah, go back and forth.
Francois, thank you very, very much. That was super enlightening. And I hope that, I know as a matter of fact that some of my good friends are fans. You know, Ahmed.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ahmed is a guy that always calls me. He's like, Dr. Montero, let's go. Let's get in the plane. And I've gone, I've gone with him, but yeah, it's something that I don't feel like going to a place to do, but I think that if I had it in my house, I would do a little bit more. Well, and to your point, Francois, I guess this is a take home message, which is, you know, if it feels good and it makes you feel good and it gives you a boost of energy and you are doing it in under controlled circumstances and you are aware of the risks and you're not necessarily a vasculopath, then by all means.
Mm-hmm. And protect your hands and your feet. That's also the the take home message.
The five extremities.
The five extremities.
Cut that out. All right, we're done, guys.
All right. Francois, thank you very much, man. I do appreciate that, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Francois.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.